Welcome back to another amazing episode of Politateen, where high schoolers Varun Katathala and Damian Galvin engage in perspective-filled conversations on America's most pressing issues. Visit www.politateen.com for more content. Happy listening, guys.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politateen. I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Varun.
Not just another, the first live-streamed episode of Politateen. I'm so excited, man. I mean, Damien obviously has a good camera. I have a decent camera. I'll get a better one next week. But it still is amazing to be talking to you guys live and also have our cameras on, just putting in emotion and speaking like we would be in a real setting. Our goal eventually, like Damien and I have been talking about for quite a while, is to go in person and have these conversations live. I mean, we got a brief glimpse at it during school hours. We talked to our teachers ourselves just about these issues, but we want to go into an in-person environment. This is the closest we can get. And we're finally here, guys. We've made it. We are live. We got videos on, and it was amazing to be able to do this today.
Yeah, we got videos.
No, it is spectacular. And I think that for Politateen number 58, we were off for a couple of days now. We had one episode come out last kind of a little shift from our norm, but we'll be back this week. I think we're going to post three episodes, if I'm not mistaken. Might do a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. No promises, but this is our Monday episode coming to you guys on Monday, unless y'all are watching us live, which in that case is coming to you guys on Sunday.
Yeah.
But how has your past couple of days been, Damien?
Man, you know, we were talking about before the podcast started, and if you guys are watching us on Twitch, I guess you guys have been tuned into this conversation. Of course, the first live episode that we do, I got to have my hair all messed up. I got a haircut, and we've been laughing about this for a while. I can make myself look like John Ossoff. Obviously not going to do that for the stream. And you guys can actually watch this. We're going to see if we can get the post out on YouTube afterwards. We're going to mess around with this. You guys are finally going to be able to see us and see us talking. It's good to finally actually be able to see you. I got to turn over here to look at Varun, but it's good to be able to have a... It feels a little bit more like it's a in-person thing. You know what I'm saying? It feels a little bit more genuine. But it's been good.
We're going to see if we can make Damien look like Ossoff. Convince him to look like Ossoff at one time during this podcast. I'll convince you.
Good luck. Good luck.
No worries. I saw it before, just for our viewers.
Yeah. Yep.
and it's funny, you know. You went blank on me for a minute.
There you go. We're good.
You good?
Yeah, we're good. We're good.
All right. I'll see you again. Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about. I mean, my weekend was pretty good.
Yeah.
I was golfing the entire weekend. I golfed yesterday and today. My first two real bouts of golfing. I golfed when I was younger, but now I'm really getting into it. Hit some good drivers. Hit the range today morning and yesterday morning. It's been a boring past couple of weeks with Corona and the SATs, but now I got some free time on my hands. I've been using it that way, and it's fun training your mind to play golf and let everything else get behind you and training your mind to, you know, control your emotions that way. And I think it's really important, especially with so much going on right now. I mean, I was going on my way to the golf course on Friday, I believe, and I saw the Supreme Court rule down Texas's attorney general's a plea to, you know, overturn the results in four states. Georgia, Wisconsin were part of those things. Pennsylvania was one of those states. And that was a highly, highly, highly debated issue across the nation. So what are your thoughts on the whole case submitted by the Texas AG and how the Supreme Court ruled on it?
Yeah, so I thought that the Supreme Court did its job. I know that a lot of like Republican commentary was like the fact that, oh, you guys hated Amy COVID Barrett.
Amy Coney Barrett.
Coathanger Barrett, Amy, whatever
you wanted. Forgive me, I forget.
Whatever you wanted to call her. People were like, oh, you guys were so upset and she ruled in your favor. It's like there is no favorable ruling. It's they did their job as Supreme Court justices. Yes, technically, thank you. She did rule, I guess, in our favor, but she ruled in the favor of the Constitution. And ironically, she ruled in the favor of democracy. And she has no loyalty to Donald Trump. I mean, there's not much that he can do to her now that he's on the, or now that she's on the court. It's just ridiculous, man. It's just ridiculous. And this is one of the things that genuinely pisses me off, talking about the idiots in our democracy that are trying to disrespect and go against every single thing that we stood for. I remember talking to my neighbor before the election. He's a Vietnam veteran, God bless his soul. And he's one of the sweetest guys that you ever meet. And he's a big Trump supporter. And but the thing that comes to him before Trump, before politics, is the country. He fought for Vietnam. You know, the whole point of the Vietnam War was to stop the spread of communism. to show that that democracy that democracy will prevail. So it was a it's a big pain in the ass to see all these people going against democracy.
Well, yeah, it definitely is. I mean, you talked about Amy Coney Barrett. Sorry, I keep forgetting, Damien. But we talked about that, and before she got actually appointed and completely confirmed, Trump was going out and saying that Amy Coney Barrett would secure the Republican majority, which he would use in the case that Biden won the election, in the case of voter fraud, widespread voter fraud. And so the fact that she voted against him in a unanimous decision, except for a couple of dissenters who still voted with the majority but just had some dissenting opinions, Alito and Clarence Thomas had those opinions, but everybody else was unanimously against this by any proportion. And so the fact that he tried to bank on Amy Coney Barrett and the rest of the conservative majority in the SCOTUS to get his decision through, and they didn't follow through and they stepped up for democracy is a testament to not only their political views, but also to the fact that, you know, it's really good that we have a Supreme Court that is not tied down by term limits and by things like that. You know, I think it's important for us to consider the fact that the Supreme Court does not have elections. It's appointed. It's a lifelong position. And that does create a sense of accountability to the American people and not just to these political overlords, which in many senses is President Trump and his majority. Now, you talk about the 100 Republican senators or representatives, forgive me, who voted with the amicus curiae brief, which told the Supreme Court to come out and overrule the election results and basically to deny and ignore these results. And for the biggest states, for the states that did vote for Joe Biden, they will cast their electoral votes for Joe Biden in the next couple of weeks. And they said to deny these votes from these states. Now, that's a big, you know, statement to make, right? Because you're talking about the Supreme Court being an arbiter of justice between a state and another state. And that, you know, usually only happens during water law and issues like that. But to say the Supreme Court is that central authority on these state-to-state matters is something that I would say is a very, very broad overreach of what their power is. And especially in a case like this, right? Talk about Bush versus Gore. That was 1,000 votes, less than 1,000 votes, 567 votes, I believe, in Florida. And that's not the measure of 10,000, 12,000 votes in Georgia at the very, very least. Yeah. Right. And what's happening right now is that every single part of their case is so fundamentally flawed to where there's no reality in which the Supreme Court justices would want to admit their case as fact. And you know that they want to. Right. They want to make Donald Trump the president. But I think that politically it's suicide for the legacy, the reputation and what they stand for to do so. It doesn't matter if you're conservative or liberal. It is political suicide. And on the other end, you have justices thinking that's political suicide and the 100 representatives thinking that them voting for democracy is political suicide, which it may very well be. But the fact that it is political suicide says a lot about us, our democracy, and what we believe in as people and what we're willing to support.
Yeah, absolutely. And sorry for my camera freezing up like half the time here. We're obviously we're working through all these issues, but we're happy to be actually able to see each other. So as the weeks progress and as more and more episodes are filmed, we're actually gonna, you know, get through these technical difficulties. But man, it's mind boggling to me. And you talk about political suicide and you talk about the term limits and stuff. I was talking to a couple people about Federalist 51, written by Madison. And it talks about factions, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was 51 that talks about factions. And the whole point, for those of you that aren't informed on Federalist 51, you should read all the Federalist Papers. But, you know, the Federalist 51 is a very important one.
There's a lot.
What, it's like 70, right? Yeah. It's like 70 essays?
70 essays, but we don't read all of them. We read like 11 or 12.
Yeah, yeah. I would recommend that everyone reads all of them. They're important to knowing how to defend our democracy and knowing how to defend especially if you're a Democrat, like obviously you want bigger government. So read the Federalist Papers and you'll have a better argument, especially when, you know, conservatives always use the approach of that's not what our founding fathers wanted. It's like, well, here's what the founding fathers wrote. But either way, in Federalist 51, it talks about factions and basically just groups that represent different ideas. And the one that I always equate it to is pro-life and pro-choice. Right. And so everyone is going to have a different take. Voters are going to have a different take on pro-life and pro-choice. But it's very hard to find a specific candidate that's pro-life, pro-choice, pro-choice, pro-gun control, pro-environment, this issue, that issue, where he's just basically all your ideas. fit into one. So the idea behind these different factions was that the politicians were going to have to see which factions would get them the most voters and then support those factions. So in a sense, majority rules here in the United States. What's happening now is that it's turning into like a fandom where it's like the factions are being based off of what the politicians are saying, not what the constituents are saying. And what I mean by that is like if Donald Trump was like, I'm pro-choice, I feel like 40, whatever, 70 million people that voted for him would be like, yeah, me too. That's cool. Where it's like, that's not the, that's counterintuitive to democracy. The point is that the politician is supposed to say, hey, what do my constituents believe? Oh, my constituents typically on the right are pro-life. All right, I'm pro-life. But it seems like Donald Trump could literally, as he said before, shoot someone in the middle of Times Square and people would still vote for him, which is wrong. It literally goes against the idea of democracy in every fundamental way.
Yeah. And I think that it's become, and I think, were you done there or did you want to talk
more? Yeah, I was done. You're good.
All right, awesome. So my idea was that it's more of a reality show right now than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that, you know, before we're talking about real policies, substantive things that people could implement in their daily lives, like gun control and reforms like this, but now it's all voting upon a person. And when you forget the policies behind that person, it becomes a very slippery slope. Because now you're voting for Donald Trump, no matter what his ideas are, or Joe Biden, or Kamala Harris, no matter what her ideas or past are. It's important to confront those ideas and their past. I mean, I've confronted Joe Biden's past, Kamala Harris's past. I don't think they're the most perfect candidates, but for me, I would support some of their initiatives. For example, for Joe Biden, I don't support his gun control measures. I think they're too extreme. And that's my personal opinion, but I'm voting for him or another candidate. Now, the fact of what's happening in the radical or the far right and the radical or the far left is that it's becoming a very, very cult-like majority. You talk about AOC, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump. You talk about Matt Gaetz. I think that's more of a cult-forming majority in which no matter what happens, it goes. Because they're so subscribed to the myth of, you know, if I don't believe in this, I'm not a true Republican. Or if I don't believe this, I'm not a true Democrat or a true AOC supporter. It's hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's all about the peer pressure because I went to the golf course today. Again, I went to, you know, St. Marlowe's golf course, a very affluent community, and the people inside weren't wearing a mask, the workers at the pro shop, and we saw another person come in with a mask on, and he saw them not wearing a mask, and he takes his mask off immediately, and he says, well, that's stupid of me to wear one. And so I looked at it, and I was like, well, it's a perfect example of peer pressure. And I think that every single person, no matter what party or political ideology you are subscribed to, a lot of people are a part of that spectrum and that kind of sheep mentality of I'll follow whoever's a leader no matter what they're saying. I think it's important for us, and like Matt Lieberman says this and Joe Lieberman says this, it's important for us to drop our labels and to embrace the idea that we all can have different ideas and different visions, not have to agree with every single thing that our favorite candidate says or does, because at the end of the day, they are a candidate. We're not voting specifically for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. We're voting for, you know, pro-choice or pro-life.
Yep.
We're voting for gun control. Yep. Or the Second Amendment. Yep. And it's important for us to remember that it's not just that name, but it's the ideas under that name that fundamentally change who we are voting for.
Exactly. That's always what I've said, right? I never – listen, I have my camera set up in a different way than I did for the live stream. If you guys watched that live stream, that was an amazing live stream. But I have the Biden 2020 flag in my room. I don't endorse Joe Biden. I endorse policies, and I've said this multiple times, and actually an interesting conversation that we were having, and hell, even a conversation that we can have here on the podcast, is, you know, Joe Biden's racist past, and the fact that, you know, I still believe that Joe Biden does have a racist past, and you saw the audio, did you see the audio leak of him meeting with the civil rights leaders?
I did. And, do you think that was racist? I didn't think it was racist.
I feel like it was insensitive. I feel like it was insensitive, and it sounded like a Donald Trump quote, if I'm going to be completely honest.
Are you talking about the leader to Joe Biden or Joe Biden to the leader?
Joe Biden to the leader, where Joe Biden said, I've done more in these couple days than any other candidate has ever done. And it just sounded like a Trump quote, and it pissed me off.
I think he was making a point. I think in my personal opinion, if we're going to talk about this for a quick minute,
go for
my
it.
Opinion was what we've been talking about for a long time, right?
Yeah.
The fact that Joe Biden has done a lot in the past couple of days in terms of his nominations. And we've been talking about it for a long time. Last episode, we talked about how Joe Biden nominated the most diverse cabinet, the most diverse group of secretaries ever compiled in the history of the USA for, you know, all practical comparisons. And that, I think, is important to consider. And Joe Biden put that through. He's like, well, let's hold back here and talk about how much I have done instead of how far I need to go beyond that. And yeah. I think that what they were asking for was unreasonable demands. They were threatening him during that meeting. And I saw the leaked tape on the leaked recording from the whole meeting. And one of the biggest issues that I had with what the civil rights leader was saying on the offensive was that he was talking about how if Joe Biden didn't appoint a black attorney general, a black AG, then he would literally pull support and it would be hard for him to get things done. And I think that when you have such a big threat, given that your presidency, you have to respond with a big threat. And I think that what Joe Biden did wasn't a big threat, because you know Joe Biden, mm-hmm. right? It's uncharacteristic of Joe Biden to have a threat given out. I think what he did was talking about his record and how he did appoint people of diversity. And I'm not sure if it came out the wrong way, but if it may have come out the wrong way. But I think that the point there was really good.
Yeah. I think that it came off a little bit insensitive. And we've been having this discussion, I think, for a while now. I've been... obviously, we talk, you know, on the podcast about different our different ideas and our different shifting points of views. I've been listening to this Twitch streamer, and I keep bringing him up, and I think that he's just an amazing guy, and he's made me want to stream on Twitch, so I might be streaming here on Twitch, and you guys should follow if you guys are interested in following. But I'm going to be streaming and just reacting to clips and kind of doing what he does. But if you guys want to see a really dope Twitch streamer that talks about like these issues and substantive issues and matters, Hassan Abai. He's an awesome streamer, and he runs on a really progressive platform. He was a host of the Young Turks, and I've been listening to what he has to say and his opinions and stuff, and he's been drawing me in a little bit. And I'm not saying that I'm socialist mm-hmm. or anything, but Marxism, you know, these Marxist ideas aren't sounding that bad. And me and Varun Varun's been hammering me for it, because I'm supposed to be the centrist one on the podcast. He's like, come on, man, you can't fall for Marxism. I can't go from centrist to Marxist. And I said, watch me. I was like, watch me go from centrist to Marxist. But no, we've been like discussing these different ideas and these different points of views. And one thing that that was discussed earlier this week was the murder, the execution, the killing of Brandon Bernard. I don't know. Did you hear about that, Varun?
Brandon Bernard. Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was big on that issue.
And the thing that was like really upsetting. What are your thoughts on the death penalty?
Well, I think that in some cases it provides a purpose, but in many cases it is very, very, first of all, monetarily expensive, right?
Extremely.
And the idea is extremely. And to keep a person in jail is much cheaper than having them die in an electric chair or by lethal injection. The cost of that is extremely high. And then beyond that, it's I think the proper punishment for somebody who did commit a crime of, you know, worthy of capital punishment is life in prison. Think about how solitary or life in prison, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. If you have that kind of sentencing, I think that it does provide a big impact upon your life. It's very strenuous. And I think that death is an easy way out. And I think that there's no practical purpose for death except like what Brandon Bernard's the people who did, you know, advocate for his death, the family of those who died as a result of him and his gang members' murder, the murder that they perpetuated. The family was like, well, the only way we can get rid of the sin is by committing another sin. Or not the exact wording they used, but they were like, by killing another person. He deserves this. It's an eye for an eye is essentially what they said. And I believed for so long that an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. Mahatma Gandhi, read that up. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. I think that you can't kill somebody because of that hatred for a and the issue right now is it's not just him who was killing the person. He was 18 years old, part of a gang, and the whole gang came together and killed that person. And yes, it was a heinous crime, but death is not the issue that puts an issue at rest every single time. I think that it takes personal rediscovery and being able to forgive a person and being able to live with the person being alive and even suffering in jail to get past that. And it's a jumbled kind of series of thoughts I'm having on right now, but I think the death is not the approach we have to use. I mean, the death penalty, first of all, is very seldomly used. President Trump reinstated that earlier this year. He usually a lame duck president doesn't allow for a death penalty to go into order, executions to happen, but this lame duck president did. In the past, 200 years, we haven't seen a lame duck president put a person to death in a federal jail, and that happened this year. But beyond the point, I think that it is a disservice to those who are hurt by these crimes, and also is a big monetary cost, which serves really no purpose whatsoever. So no, yeah. I revoke my statement. There is no purpose to it in any scenario.
I don't even think that, listen, you want to see me kill my political career in three words? Actually, I don't know how many words I'm gonna say, but watch, this is gonna become a commercial in like in 20 years if I ever run for. Oh, goddamn, in like 10 years. Holy crap, we're old, man. We can run for like Senate. We can run as senators in like 10 years. It's ridiculous. But either
Oh
way,
yeah.
you want to.
Give it three losing.
You...
Give it three campaigns that we lose, and we'll come in somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Watch, but watch me. Watch
We're
me.
on a 25.
Watch me give a free advertisement to anyone that's re the Republican that's going to run against me. I don't think that life in prison is humane. And I think that it goes against the United States values. And I think that the death penalty is disgusting. And anyone that advocates for it, first of all, you can't be pro-life and advocate for the death penalty. You're a clown. Second of all, the president of the United States is a clown. He's a boy. He's petty. Honestly, I would be using a lot more profane words. He's
Can we stay, can we stop saying Mr. President? Can we say boy in the White House? I
you're
would love
like
to say that.
the
I like it.
hey the
Can we make an
boy
agreement?
listen, what about we do this? The boy leaving the White House.
The boy leaving the White
The
House.
boy leaving the White
That is
House.
good.
All
Good with me. I'm gonna write that down. Every single
right.
time I want to say Trump, boy in the White, boy leaving the White House.
The boy
Good
leaving the
one.
White House. But I think that it's disgusting and he's a piece of garbage. Because of the death penalty. It goes, I mean, it's just, first of all, let me talk about my statement that I made about life in prison. 23 hours a day in solitary confinement is what Bernard spent. Brandon Bernard, 23 hours a day alone. Man, some of us are complaining about pay. I mean, I'm going through a lot of mental health issues, having to be in my house for so much time. I'm in my house. I'm talking to people right now. I'm talking to Varun. I can use my computer. I can play video games. I can go upstairs and read. I can go outside and get fresh air whenever I want. I can cook something if I really want to. How I can go for a drive if I really need to. 23 hours a day alone for 21 years. Dude, this sounds like ISIS torture techniques. What are we doing in the United States? 23 hours a day alone? Are you kidding? And then
I have a
what's
counter though.
okay?
Yeah,
What's
go
your
ahead
counter?
once you finish your point.
What's what?
My
Okay,
counter is the
yeah, go
fact
for it.
that the heinous crimes that these people have committed, I would say we are okay with doing that. I
I
mean,
disagree.
it is, you disagree with
I
that?
dis I disagree completely. First of all, I want to say.
My thing is like, solitary is not the solution. I'm not talking
Okay.
about solitary
Okay.
life in prison. I'm talking about life in prison.
Okay.
And that's not just sitting in a cell for 23 hours a day. I would say start there. And if they have good behavior and they're doing good things, and if they're not, you know, the most heinous criminal, then yes, let them out into the prison and let them out and give them life in prison. But the fact is that if a person has murdered people in society, they shouldn't be let back into society. I would never allow that kind of person to be back in society. Sure, give them a way to level up in prison, but don't let them back into my neighborhoods and my places of worship, things like that. And it sounds like it is unreasonable from this pulpit, but I would say the crimes that I've seen people commit on death row are disgusting. Disgusting.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
What did they have?
Yeah. Sorry about that. Oh, what was I gonna say? No, I mean,
Talking about death row.
yeah. Sorry, sorry,
Yeah.
sorry. My mind just completely blanked. Listen, I, Brandon Bernard was a criminal. He was a criminal, and he did commit a heinous crime, and he did murder that woman. She died. I'm not saying that none of this is true. All of this is true. He deserved. He was not innocent by any means. But life in pr justice is not revenge. R rather, revenge is not justice. We don't get any. Actually, we
Then
lost
again,
it.
he was fighting for life in prison.
Yeah,
Bernard was fighting for
I
life in prison.
understand, but I don't even think life
Put
in
that quick,
prison.
yeah.
I think this is what I'd rather do. You know, what is it? It costs, how much does it cost to kill someone? $2 million?
Here's my question. Would you want Bernard to come back into
Yes.
society?
Yes. I want Brandon
Really?
Bernard to be rehabilitated and to be a functioning member of society again because he serves no purpose in life in prison. We might as well just take him out to a shooting range and kill him. That's genuinely what I believe.
The issue is that it is, I would say that there's two solutions.
Okay.
When a person commits a crime like murder, there is no path to reentry into society for me. Because the first thing is that if they get reentered into society, what lays out for them? First of all, nobody's going to admit a murderer into any position ever. And second of all, there's a real threat in terms of people killing them. If Brandon Bernard was like back into society, people would shoot him at his own house. And that would be another issue for, you know, working through that. But beyond that, when a person kills another human, takes a human life, I think that there has to be some kind of retribution. Obviously, it's not death, because death is unpractical. Yeah. I would say it's impractical. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why I'm against the death penalty. But in terms of retribution,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
An eye for an eye isn't the best solution in this circumstance, for the sole reason that an eye for an eye doesn't solve the issue. Retribution, it may come in terms of life in jail, life in prison, but I think that protects the people who it needs to protect in our society, in American society.
Listen, I think that I'm speaking from a very idealist standpoint. I think that from an idealist standpoint, that this would work. Let me just make this statement clear. I am against life in prison. From a logical, idealistic standpoint, right? I'm against this idea of housing inmates for 23 hours a day, 4 days a week. 7 days a week, 23 hours a day, with 1 hour of being able to go out. I'm morally against that idea. And I think that most Americans should be against that idea. I think that all Americans should be against that idea. I mean, that is cruel and unusual punishment, and killing someone is cruel and unusual. When we're talking about the things that we fight for in this country and the wars that we've gone to and the people that we attack, when we're talking about terrorists and all of this stuff, I mean, these are terrorist torture techniques. But beyond that, from an idealist standpoint, I think that we should all be against life in prison. I think that that in a perfect world, we rehabilitate prisoners. The thing that pisses me off about the United States of America, and I don't want to hear any junk about, oh, well, if you hate the country so much, why don't you leave it? Because that's bogus. And that's also just, that's bull from every standpoint, because now Trump supporters are the ones crying, saying that they're going to leave because the democratic process took place and their little boy that's leaving the White House lost. So this is what I want to say. We need to start. We can have the life in prison discussion later. In America, we look at revenge as justice, and it's wrong. It's fundamentally wrong from every single point of view. What's the prison pipeline, man? It's literally, it's the prison to prison pipeline, if I'm not mistaken. Like 70% of people that go to federal prison or that go to prison end up back in prison. You know what that says? That says that we're doing a shit job, to be frank. That's what it says. It says that we're doing a horrible job as Americans in rehabilitating our prisoners. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to let them vote again. We're supposed to make sure that they're not just seen as felons for the rest of their lives. How the hell are you going to get a job and be a productive member of society without having to sell crack cocaine on the street if you can't get a job at Taco Bell because another felon is working there at the same time? You know, it's bogus. And there's so many steps that we need to take. Oh, hold on. I can't hear you. Hold on. Can you hear me? Oh, I can't hear you. Okay. While Varun's talking, I'm going to keep complaining about from a standpoint, I was actually having this conversation. It's a problem with how we look at job positions and job hirings in general. Sorry. I know that the stream is being very laggy for you guys. I hope that you guys can still hear my audio well. But this is a problem that we have in general when applying to jobs in the United States. We evaluate credit scores. Do you understand how stupid that is to evaluate credit scores in the United States of America in order to get a job? So if you have a low credit score, you can't get a job. Well, let's look at the problem with this, right? So if you have a low credit score, you can't get a job. So if you can't get a job, then you can't pay off the debt that you're in. So then you can't get another job. So then you have a low credit score. So then you can't get a job. So what are you supposed to do as a member of society at this point? Are you supposed to just be lazy and then live off of welfare like Republicans complain about African Americans doing, the lazy welfare queen? Right? Like that's racist, first of all. And you're just trying to find nice, cute, cutesy ways of just, I mean, calling black people lazy, and they're not. And oftentimes, first of all, people can't even live off of welfare. The people that actually need it, our welfare system is broken in the United States of America. But even beyond that, right, let's talk about the fact that these so-called welfare queens, why can't they get jobs? Maybe they can't get jobs because of a systemic problem that's been caused by, I mean, slavery in the past in the United States of America. So when your parents can't build credit, then you can't build credit, and you have nothing to build credit off of. So you can't get a job working at AT&T. You can't get a job in a bank if you can't build credit. You can't get a high school diploma. You can't get student loans. So again, you're left with essentially no options. And I'm not saying that we should excuse these people that commit these heinous crimes, right? Because they did commit these crimes and they made the decision in themselves to commit them. Sorry that Varun's having these issues, by the way. But they did make these decisions by themselves to commit these crimes. Obviously, they're subject to their environment by every single way that you could take that. They are subject to their environment. And they did make these decisions because they had no other decisions. But nonetheless, they deserve to face, you know, time in prison, time in jail, whatever suits the crime that they committed. But we also have to say, okay, how can we stop them from committing these crimes in the future? And I think that that's something that we fail at as Americans. We fail at asking the question on how we can get, still can't hear you. Don't stress out about it, man. I'm having fun talking about all of America's problems. I'll get them all solved by the time you get your audio connected. but no. As I was continuing on, we fail as Americans to be able to rehabilitate our prisoners, and it's a big issue because. Oh, there you go.
Oh my God! It took like 10 minutes. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. I was talking about just how we fail as Americans just to rehabilitate our prisoners and the fact that a felon comes out of prison.
Yeah.
And they're seen as a felon and they can't get a job at Taco Bell because there's another felon working there and they can't get a job at McDonald's. So 70% of prisoners go back to prison.
I mean, we talked about recidivism a lot. I think we talked about it a lot with Larry Lawton and a lot of other guests on the podcast. That's not the same conversation as, you know, people who have committed crimes like murder and like rape and them getting back into society. I think that it is a very valid discussion in terms of people who did sell drugs or, you know, smoke cocaine or have weed on them. That's a very valid discussion because they don't pose an immediate threat to society. I would say recidivism for people who did rape a person, kidnap a person, abuse children, that is not a discussion I'm willing to have. But if you want to talk about recidivism, absolutely. I think that we have to fix a lot of things. The first step back is a good solution if we implement it right. If you look at President Trump, the one good thing that I would say about President Trump is the first step back. And that's a bipartisan approach, first of all. And I think that it's a good act that Republicans and Democrats both coagulated to create. And what it does is it creates that pipeline and it betters the pipeline to get back into life from prison. And the issue right now is that we don't provide prisoners enough things to do while they're in prison, like GEDs or art programs or reading programs to where they can learn things while they're in jail. And now when you see people coming out of prison, they have no skills and they can't get a job anywhere at McDonald's or anywhere because nobody wants to accept a felon. Nobody wants to accept somebody who's been to jail. And so it's a societal norm. The way you do it is by hiding their status if they're not one of those rapists, abusers, or, you know, murderers who society needs to know about. But if they're a person who sold a couple of pounds of weed or marijuana, that should be hidden on employer identification numbers and forms like that. And yeah. I think that once we reform these things, it would be better. But the first step back is a very good approach. And I say it because President Trump and the Republicans and Democrats together created that approach to give people in federal prisons enough programs like GED creating programs, educational programs in jails to where they can get credit for learning in jail and also rehabilitate themselves back to a civilian life and re-enter that norm. I think it also begins by creating those pipelines to where the First Step Act can be implemented. One of the biggest issues I've seen with the First Step Act is that one of their main platforms is by providing more halfway houses to put people back into rehab. But the issue is that President Trump has been denying halfway houses continuously. And so when you see those things, you know, kind of coagulate, it does not match up. When you put them together, it doesn't match up how President Trump has passed this act into order, but still refuses to have more halfway houses, how President Trump has passed this act into order, but still refuses to give congressional oversight to make sure these regulations are being followed, because in many of these facilities, federal prisons I'm talking about, these things aren't being followed. People are still being not given the right to have a GED, have educational programs. The backlog for these programs is extremely high. There's lines going up to 100 prisoners who are waiting for the opportunity to get an education, to learn, to, you know, receive the opportunity to better themselves. And that's not okay in the United States of America. A lot of things are not okay in the United States of America. Yeah. And I think that it begins, number one, by making sure these programs that we do have in place are being implemented. One of the things that I believe in is that we have the resources. It takes grit. It takes motivation to implement those resources to produce results. And if we can, you know, get that determination, that persistence to produce the results, I see a future ahead. But I think that to end here, reform is good. We have the tools. We should use them. But I think reform is, to take a step back here, reform is for people who haven't committed crimes like rape, child abuse, and murder. To them, my perspective is they don't deserve a place back into society. It's unsafe for us as people to have them back into society, and they deserve to live a life in prison, in my perspective.
Okay. So you would not want to see a murderer reformed and brought back into society?
I would never know if they had been reformed, okay, because they committed a crime like taking somebody else's life.
You see, that's a solid answer. But I think that the correct answer is, yeah, I'd want to see one genuinely reformed.
Absolutely. Yeah. In a utopia, the perfect world,
yep,
I would see it as a possibility. I'd love to see it. Yeah. But I think I'm talking about right. You know, I'm a pragmatist. I'm a big pragmatist. Yes. I believe in realities. And I think that realistically, there's no way to ensure that these people won't go out and kill somebody else because of instinct.
The thing that I struggle with, right, is who are we if we don't try? I feel like we're just giving up on our prisoners. And I understand, listen, the conversation right now, we can't just be like, hey, we should set murderers free after 15 years like they do in Norway, right? Because that's what they do in Norway. In Norway, they let a life sentence is 15 years. And so it's in Sweden too. And honestly, they have high success rates at rehabilitating murderers and rapists, as you've talked about. And what they do is if they go, hey, after 15 years, this person does not look like they've been rehabilitated, then they give them essentially another trial and they say, this person has not been rehabilitated. They're not good to go back into society. They still are a menace to society. And I'm not saying that that necessarily is the correct approach here in the United States. But the reason that I don't have grounds to say that is because we can't even deal with someone that has like half a gram of cocaine on them properly. We give them like 20 years, like, you know.
So let's talk about that first.
Yeah,
because I think we have
that's exactly we have to work on that before we can work on murderers. Because how are we going to sit here and talk about child rapists when we can't even figure out the right way to deal with someone getting a traffic violation?
And what happens, right? It's when you can't deal with these people that people think it's okay to, first of all, get into cocaine and then go kill a person, then go kidnap a person. The pipeline continues.
Yep.
So it is, I think that it's creating generations. And number one, I forgot to mention this. It's the idea that a lot of these people are born out of necessity. They're criminals who are born out of necessity. And so the number one thing that we can do, and I speak to all of our viewers here, is number one, by making sure these Black communities, these poverty impoverished communities, they, you know, Black incarceration is lowered. Because what's happening right now is you have women, you have children grown up without fathers. Women growing up without husbands, and their husbands are in jail, and they continue to hate law enforcement, hate the legal system. And because of that, and because of necessity to gain, you know, some bread, to gain some money, and to live another day, they have to resort to crime, resort to selling drugs. And I think that that's become a norm in these communities. And number one, it's not about cracking down upon gangs. It's about making sure we incarcerate the right people and start creating community-centered programs to say drugs are not okay. There is another approach to this. And making sure we give people the out from prison. You give them the opportunity to go back to their families. And we create a better solution for Black people in our impoverished communities, because it's not being racist. It's the idea that the majority of people in these low-income city places are African-American. And that's the reality. Yeah. So I think if you go into these communities and reform these kinds of things, then you'll see solutions. You'll see immediate results. It begins in jails. And it also begins in cities. It begins in areas where crime is high, street crime is high. And I think that's the solution to all of this.
I think that the solution to all of this is education. It's education in white schools. It's education in Black schools. It's education in prison. It's education in the American household. And I mean, like, first of all, let's just talk about, if we want to, I mean, we can have like a 4-hour podcast here if we want to talk about redlining and stuff. But let's talk about the issue, basically, being that in African-American communities, schools, if you don't know, are paid for by property tax. And in African-American communities, the property is typically worth less. So the property tax is typically lower. So the schools are typically worse. And the teachers are underpaid and the programs are underfunded. Whereas in a white community, right, we have, I think the example that's typically used is you have, be like, what's it called? Racial appropriation. Is that the proper term that I'm using here? appropriation, cultural appropriation.
Cultural appropriation.
That's what I was looking for. But I'm going to culturally appropriate with names here. You have Kyle living in a living in a white community, and you have Jamal living in an African American community. Now, Kyle's house is, I mean, he lives with white neighbors. Their property's worth more, and we can talk about the systemic reasons why this is so. But let's just talk about the issues right now, because this is just solidly a fact right now. You know, Kyle's house is worth more, so he pays higher property taxes, so his schools are better, so he gets a better education, while Jamal's house is worth less. He lives around people whose houses are worth less, so his school is in turn lower quality, his teachers get underpaid, and his programs are underfunded. Okay, so what happens? Typically, Jamal also can't afford to go to college, and he doesn't have the education in order to get into top colleges, where Kyle can get into college with, everyone always talks about, the thing that lets like African Americans and Hispanics get into schools easier.
Pell grants.
Yeah, sure.
Or affirmative action.
There it is. Affirmative action. But the thing is, Jamal doesn't have the grades to even apply to these schools, let alone be accepted by affirmative action. So the problem is that typically, you know, it'll be a perpetual cycle of him returning to crime, of Jamal returning to crime, and Kyle getting accepted into different schools. Now, this is a problem. So we have to re-educate, and it starts with taxes and stuff, but in the most simple approach, we have to make sure that both of them have an equal opportunity to education. Not charter schools, because charter schools are dog. I think the charter schools are horrible as well, but the vouchers. What do you think about a voucher program?
Well, here, I'm going to talk about something before that, because I think it's going to blow your mind.
Okay,
I'm going to talk about Jamal's solution. Jamal's solution is trade schools. It's vocational schools. Because what that does is it provides, I think that trade schools, vocational schools, are the next biggest thing, a substitute for places like UGA or things like that, the university system in Georgia. I think people don't give those schools enough credit because they have low-cost education. They give you what you need to go pursue a lifestyle, go pursue a job, and you can get these certifications for a low cost and make six figures. Right. And you can go to trade school, learn programming, learn plumbing, learn whatever you need to learn. And you get these skills and use them in everyday life, get a job almost immediately. And that's what you need. And beyond that, you need schools focused upon careers. It's not just about going to college. It's about going into a job from day one. We go to a school, Damien, you and I go to a school where all we do is learn about law, and people learn about cybersecurity. They learn about things like that. And what that allows people to do is they have certifications that will get them a job on day one. My friend David. He has, I'm naming him right here, but he has a certification for Adobe, and he can go into any small business software firm and get a job immediately. And so what this allows him to do is get a job off the bat without a college education. And so you need to implement those programs. And beyond that, also give people the opportunity to get a GED out of jail. Education is the central piece to all of this. And Joe Biden has proposed it. He's proposed giving people free education to public universities and trade schools if they make under $125,000 a year. He has proposed it.
That's the
it's going to be hard to achieve.
That's the solution.
But he's proposed it. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and I'm kind of blanking here. What was I going to – come back to me. Go ahead.
I got you. Yeah, no. I like – and, man, I don't get this. I don't get this whole idea about people complaining about, like free college, and I'm not going to pay for another kid's college. It was the same discussion that was being had, 200 years ago about high school, when you had to pay to go to high school and you had to pay to go to middle school. People would be like, oh, I don't want my tax dollars to go to other kids going – why not? Why wouldn't you want that? Why wouldn't you want your tax dollars being used to make productive members of society? How else would you want your tax dollars spent?
It's not even just productive members of society. It's productive members of your society.
Your own life. It's like your environment. Your neighbors.
If you create productive people, you create a more affluent community. You create better people you're around. And so do you want – and that's a code word, guys. And I'm saying this because this is my opinion, not necessarily fact. My opinion is I don't want to pay for his education is the code word for I don't want to pay for black kids' education.
It is.
I don't want to pay for an African American's education.
It's a dog whistle. And unfortunately, I think that we're getting away from dog whistles in America, and we're just starting to use bullhorns, if I'm going to be quite honest. We're getting away from dog whistles. Politicians used to be kind of like, oh, let me be like sort of racist, but like underground race. I think that we're just being racist now. And I think that it's unfortunate. And it happened when Donald Trump talked about the housing program. But yes, I think that the solution does start with making sure that there's less prisoners, and the way to do that is prison reform first and foremost. But the second best way to do that is an education system that allows those in low income communities to be able to go to college. And you talked about our school and how it's focused, how it's a career focused school. But how's our school funded, man? Like our school is funded because we're in the county that we're in officially became the richest county in our state. If I'm not mistaken,
right?
It officially, and it's the fastest growing.
And here's the big thing: yeah. It's a rich community, a heavily predominantly white community. It's growing more diverse as we speak. But the thing is that Forsyth County was the number 5 place in the entire nation to flip Democratic.
Yeah.
In this election.
Wow.
The number 5 or 6 place in the entire, a plus 14.6 flip democratically, and there are 71 and 81. To 10% or 15%, whatever you want to call it, Hillary to Trump county. And they voted for Trump with like 81% of the vote. And this year it was like 60. Yeah. And so it's like you're getting so many votes from Forsyth County. And I think that I wanted to tell you guys a tale about the Midnight Basketball Club, right? I want to tell you all about Joe Biden and the Midnight Basketball Club. And what that was with the 1994 crime bill, which people talk about Joe Biden, get him flack for it, give him flack all you want. But within that 1994 crime bill to curb violent crime, they implemented a thing called midnight basketball clubs. So basically, you had people in downtown areas who were prone to violent crime going out, and they got the opportunity to participate in this basketball club at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the night, which is, you guys know, it's when violent crime begins. You have gang activities. People go on the streets at 11 o'clock p.m. That's what happens. So at that time, they had basketball clubs. They had rec leagues. That's when the whole rec league lifestyle began. And after the rec leagues, the most interesting thing happened. They had GED lessons. They had art lessons. They had camps to give people the opportunity to increase education, give them the hope to say there is a way out. It's not just, getting into violent crime, murdering people, hurting people, threatening them for money. It's about giving them the hope that they need to get a way out. And they found a way to do it. And the way was through finding what they like the most and adapting to that.
Yeah.
But I think that now, and that was a bipartisan solution. And I think that's one of the most incredible solutions I've seen in my entire life. It dropped violent crime. But I think now we have to find a way to connect to those nonviolent offenders and give them that same opportunity to really reform and give them that hope. Because I think it's bipartisan that we want people to have hope. We don't want to hurt people. I would at least suspect not. We don't want to hurt people. So if we present it that way, instead of saying we're going to, put more money into colleges, let's say we're going to put more money into hope. Because I think that's a solution that everybody will be able to get behind. And I think that Barack Obama, I said hope, and I immediately thought of Barack Obama, whose book I'm reading right now. Talk about hope. Barack Obama's whole mission was hope. And that's why Barack Obama got so many votes. So if we can put that hope tagline and I'm a Democrat, as Democrats on every single, prison pipeline, all those reforms, and put that out there as a hope solution, I think you would get results that you never expected in your entire life.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And genuinely, and you were referring to nonviolent crimes. But you see what happens.
I was referring to
You referred specifically to nonviolent crimes. But you see what happens here is that when you give these people hope, literally in the sense, and they get to go to college, their kids are less prone to violent crimes. Because if you want to talk about gang-related crimes, you want to know how to curb that. You give people an education. Because why do people turn to gangs? Statistically speaking, right? Statistically speaking, people turn to gangs when they're missing a father figure in their household, when they have an unstable household, and the reason that they do is because gangs provide a family setting. I think that we can all agree on that as Americans.
We can.
If we can't, then I mean, you need re-education. That's why people turn to gangs and to gang activity. It's because these gangs provide a family in a sense, and it's the same thing with mobs, to be honest. But mobs, I think, are more pristine, to be honest, in America. We honestly put mobs on a pedestal, and we look at gangs because I mean, hey, who's in mobs? Who are in mobs typically?
Rich people,
rich white Americans who are in gangs, low life, right? With air quotes, black kids. So either way, so if you make sure that people have an education and they can start a family, they go to trade school, they get a job, they have kids, then what ends up happening is that you have less gang. I mean, you're not going to see it. That's the thing. I think that that's a big issue that we have with politics in the United States is that we want results now. We want the second that let's name the bill that we're proposing, me and you, Varun, the police reform bill of 2021 or the reform bill of 2021. We want the day after the reform bill comes out for a crime to just stop 0% crime the next day.
We want the day after Joe Biden gets elected. COVID-19, stop.
Exactly.
We got no more COVID.
The thing is, with things that me and Varun are talking about, sure, we might see in a four-year period, and this is why, honestly, sometimes re-election bids are difficult and why democracy moves so slow. I mean, there's a system of checks and balances, and even beyond a system of checks and balances, we saw what a lot of the programs that Obama implemented, they were going to take years to function properly. Especially with like things that you're talking about, like the EPA. So when the next president comes in and just completely undoes them, then obviously Obama looks like a lame duck president that didn't do anything. So one thing that we have to take into consideration is even with the reform bill that we're talking about, right? Where you get, you know, Joe Biden is talking about giving free college education, to these kids, specifically for trade schools and kids that are at what, under $125,000, which is reasonable. That's a lot of money to be making. And so what you're going to see is that crime is going to go down. Crime is going to go down in America because people are becoming educated. And when you become educated, you have a leniency to turn away from doing drugs. And actually, doing marijuana is actually – okay. Either way, in a college setting, actually smoking marijuana is a lot more common than if you were to not have an education. But nonetheless, right, at least you're smoking weed and getting an education and not like smoking weed and like doing other drugs.
Here's the issue. We think it's not pervasive, and this is a simple point, because people who smoke weed or marijuana, these white people in colleges smoking weed in frat parties, they don't get arrested. People who are arrested are the black people in the streets smoking weed. And that's the issue, right? And if they were arrested the same margin, we would have – look, here's the issue. If they were arrested with the same proportion as black people in the streets, we would have police reform and nonviolent crime reform now.
Absolutely. And you want to know, the thing is, people always talk about, well, if we want to get rid of crimes, we need more police. That's, I think that's one of the most bogus claims. More police is not does not result in less crime. It actually just results in crime being caught more. So if you start throwing a bunch of police officers into white communities, there's just going to be the crime rate's going to go up because more people are being caught. It doesn't divert people from committing crime. What it does is it just results in people being caught. So we need to create a better system of community within the African American community and police officers, and that's where if you want to talk about defunding the police, that's an essential aspect of it. I like calling it refunding the police or reappropriating police funds. That's what I agree with. But either way, going back to our issue, if we were to implement our policy tomorrow, Brune, I think that in 3-4 years, we would see nonviolent crimes go down and the arrests for them go down and community. But it would take 20 years. It would take 40 years to see gang activity go down. And we would be able to look back at this bill and be like, hey, this is why gang activity went down. But in America, we just want these instantaneous solutions. And we do not live in democracy is slow. Like, it's the way that it was built, it was meant to be slow. And sure, it has its good, it has its bad. But one thing that we can't deny is the fact that it's slow. So we cannot be impatient with the democratic process. We have to let these bills take place and take their time and take reform. But, I mean, it's just – it's difficult. It genuinely is difficult because we're very impatient, I think, as Americans. And that's one thing that we have to be re-educated about. We have to be re-educated about our patience in these democratic processes. So I think that re-education, it goes a long way. But what is the response to people just like not – I don't get the whole tax argument. The whole – I've been looking into this more and more. And I don't understand how someone that makes under $400,000 – first of all, if you're African-American or Hispanic or a minority and you make under $400,000 and you voted for Donald Trump, please explain to me why. Like, please explain to me why. If you're African American, if you're a minority and you make over $400,000, at least you're getting something out of it, right? At least you get something out of a Trump presidency. But if you're African, you literally lose. Like, I'm going to talk about it from a Hispanic standpoint because I don't think that I can be deemed, I don't know, honestly, I might be canceled for Hispanic boy talks about Hispanic problems, gets canceled as racist. But if you're a Hispanic and you voted for Donald Trump and you make less than $400,000 a year, I'm sorry, that's like clown behavior. Like, I don't know what you're getting out of this. If you talk about his tax cuts, are you a corporate? Are you Starbucks? Like, are you Subway? Are you Amazon? I didn't know that you were Amazon because you're not getting any corporate tax cuts. You're not a corporation. Is this just a cult mentality that we become subject to? Oh, I can't hear you. I can't hear you again. Your audio cut out. Don't worry about it. Let's see. No, I can't hear you. Either way, I was gonna say, Hassan, again, to talk about Hassan. He was talking about this, I think, earlier. And he was talking about the whole cult mentality and the whole cult perspective and the fact that studies have shown that when a cult has been proven wrong, when a cult's ideas have been proven wrong, like example, I think he talks about the Y2K, like the end of the world, that the whole cult that believed that the world was going to end in 2012, that when they were proven wrong, and the world didn't end, that they
a couple of people,
there you go. Okay, you got your computer audio. Your audio is a little bit worse, but we can hear you now, yeah. At least.
Okay. Let me change my audio. I do have.
Hold up. Hello.
There you go. Perfect. All right. There you go. Oh.
Are we good now?
Yeah, we're good.
Hello.
Yep. We're good.
Give me a second. I will be back.
Okay. Boom.
Are we good now?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. I do have to leave. We might have to part two this, but I'm gonna quickly answer that first question.
Yeah.
Because I think you were right. When you were talking about my Bluetooth is messed up, it doesn't matter what type of income or ethnicity you are, you are going to vote for Trump because you're a Trump supporter. You love what he pervades, his enthusiasm, whatever, because your family loves it, whatever. It's a cult mentality. And so it's hard to convince people otherwise. But we can, it would definitely want a part two of this. I would say we got to do a part one, part two. And that'd be awesome. But I'm out for the day.
Yes. All right, that's there's no worries. Thank you to all our Twitch viewers. I'll actually probably be live a little bit later today. If you are listening to this podcast in post, you can check out the live stream. You can check out me live. Varun will be joining me whenever we're recording or just random times throughout the day. But I'm going to try to be a lot more live on Twitch. That's twitch.tv/Damien_Galvin. For all of those that are listening, thank you guys so much for tuning into another episode of Polititeam. Thank you, Varun, for adding to the conversation as you always do, different perspective, different outlooks and outtakes. It was an absolutely amazing episode. Be sure to check out our website. We have some cool pictures from the toy drive that we did. Big shout out to Varun for working on that. That's polititeam.com. That's simply just polititeam.com. You can check out our social media handles, both Twitter and Instagram, at Polititeam Show. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys so much for tuning into yet another episode of Polititeam Podcast. Good guy. Goodbye.
Bye, guys. Thank you so very much for listening to today's episode of Polititeam. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/Polititeam Podcast. That is www.patreon.com/Polititeam Podcast to subscribe for exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. Visit www.Polititeam Podcast for more amazing content from our sponsors. Thank you all so much for listening. Have a great rest of your day.